It's hard to imagine that anyone lives at the top of the steep incline that leads to Rosedale Ridge, but steps carved into the side of the road tell a different story. 350 low-income residents live in the 6 squat buildings of Rosedale Ridge, and most of them don't have cars. They walk up and down this hulking hill multiple times a day. But not for long. Rosedale Ridge is on the verge of being shut down. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we're talking about low-income housing, whether people are better off living together in one place or dispersing with access to housing opportunities throughout the city. To start the show, Eleanor Klibanoff takes us to Rosedale Ridge. Some residents are looking forward to getting out, while others worry that the shutdown of the housing complex is just another government promise, and everyone is wary of what's waiting for them once they get off the hill.
They won't fix anything. They won't make sure the kids are safe. They won't make sure things are taken care of. I just don't understand how you can have all of this money, all of this power, and not want to help people.
Javon Swopes lives with her 3 children, her sister, and her sister's 3 children at Rosedale Ridge. Over the past 4 years, Swopes has watched the apartments fall into disrepair and maintenance requests from the mundane to the emergency go ignored. She says she feels abandoned.
How do you have so much power and to control these things that you won't?
Swopes isn't even sure who she should be asking, and it almost doesn't matter anymore. No one has taken her calls before. Why would they start now?
You have reached Rosedale Ridge Apartments, located at 2101 South Mill Street in Kansas City, Kansas. We are currently out on the property and unavailable to take your call. If you are interested in
Rosedale itself is a little KCK neighborhood tucked between Missouri and Johnson County. At one end sits KU Medical Center. At the other end is Rosedale Ridge. It's what's usually called a housing project, a last resort option for people that need a place to live fast, like Javon Swopes.
My uncle was the one that brought me over here, and he was like, well, it's somewhere to stay.
5 years ago, Swopes worked up the courage to run from her abusive partner. She was staying in a homeless shelter with her 3 children when her uncle brought her to Rosedale Ridge.
They got me an apartment within like 3 weeks, and I'm like, this is the fastest I've ever gotten to an apartment. Okay.
After she signed her lease, Rosedale Ridge gave her an apartment that didn't have a working refrigerator or a stove at all. She put in maintenance request after maintenance request, while her neighbors just shook their heads. Didn't she know? No one was going to answer. 4 years later, she's moved units twice and found the same conditions in all of them. Every time she sees a new family move in, she feels sick for them.
They're like, bring your money. HUD's gonna pay for your portion. Just sign on the dotted line right here. Mm-hmm. Knowing behind them, you know, they got problems up the yin-yang, you know. Sign this dotted line, I'll make sure I get you an apartment. You have somewhere to stay.
Housing projects in general don't have great reputations. But Rosedale Ridge is worse than most. For one thing, it's isolated at the top of a steep hill on the other side of the railroad tracks. Until last year, it was 2.5 miles from public transportation. Even now, the bus that comes to the bottom of the hill runs once an hour. The complex is owned by a company called Creative Choice. It's based in Florida, so the company hired Yarko, a Missouri-based firm, to manage the property. Until last month, when Creative Choice brought on PPG, their own property management group, instead. I tried to get in touch with all of these companies to talk about the conditions up at Rosedale Ridge. They all declined to speak with me. Diane Richardson-Spate isn't surprised. She used to work for the property as a service coordinator and now serves as a community advocate. Richardson-Spate says no one wants to take the blame.
Yarko wants to make claim that it's the ownership's fault. Ownership wants to make claim that it's Yarko's fault. From my perspective, it's both people's fault because everybody knew this was happening.
When she worked for the property, she tried to push Yarko for answers.
You all knew this. You were on site. And, I mean, their claim is always that the owners were not paying them for the upkeep. And there wasn't enough money in the budget to actually do these things.
To understand who's at fault here is a little complicated. To begin with, there are 2 forms of low-income housing out there. The first is called tenant-based vouchers. An individual is given funds to help pay rent. They can use that anywhere a landlord will accept it. That's your best option, but the wait list is long and there are a lot of ways to be disqualified. If you don't get a tenant-based voucher, you need to go to an asset-based property. In that case, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development gives money to the apartment owners to subsidize rent for tenants based on their income. HUD also pays for upkeep and community events. Everyone involved in Rosedale Ridge says they never got the money to maintain the property. It's not clear where the HUD funding went then. But what we do know is that Rosedale Ridge continued to take on new tenants and continued to get funding from HUD. They continued to pass their local, state, and federal inspections by a hair, or fail them and pass on the second try.
Literally four times a year, all of the doors would be painted, all of the doors would be fixed, there would be mulch laid everywhere.
But residents say those were superficial changes. Inside the units, they were struggling with water damage, plumbing problems, and black mold like you wouldn't believe. One resident said she had mushrooms growing out of her carpet. In the past year or so, the mold got so bad that residents started calling HUD and the unified government directly, fearing for the health of their children. The wider community, from the schools to the Rosedale Development Association, jumped on the campaign. Resident Javon Swopes explains it like this.
They're the elephants, we're the mice. They're not going to hear us. But they came with us to be more of the mice voices, to get it out. Get it out, get it out.
And those mice voices were heard. In September, notices went up around the complex saying that Creative Choice had failed the latest inspection and everyone would have to vacate within 30 days. That didn't happen. But in December, they were reinspected and failed again. A number of the violations were life, health, and safety concerns, which are the most dangerous. Black mold, open sockets, fire hazards. At the beginning of April, 7 months after that first notice was posted, Ed Manning, the Kansas City HUD director, met with residents. The news was final. HUD had terminated their contract with Creative Choice. Everyone was going to be moved out.
Ain't nobody gonna change their mind?
No, I'm not changing my mind.
So we get to go for real. So we get to move for real?
For real.
There had been a number of these meetings over the past few months, but this one was different. Less angry and more hopeful, though not without a few questions.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, what took y'all so long?
Actually, you know, and I don't mean to be sarcastic, but this is a federal government, and actually this is pretty fast.
Rosedale Ridge residents were going to be moved to the front of the line for tenant-based vouchers. They wouldn't have to live in housing projects anymore. They could take those vouchers anywhere that would accept them. Houses, apartments.
Well, technically, if you wanted to move to California, you could.
Even better, HUD was going to pay their relocation fees. There are costs associated with moving, and the average Rosedale Ridge resident earns $6,000 a year. Javon Swopes, for one, was ecstatic. She'd gotten stuck at Rosedale Ridge, and now, finally, she was going to be free. And she had a plan for her voucher.
My pastor, he owns houses and stuff, and he's willing to take a Section 8 voucher for me and my family. You know, when he heard the news, I mean, it was kind of bad how it happened, but, you know, excited for me that I'm able to go somewhere else.
There were about 60 residents at the meeting with HUD. They left generally happy and hopeful, but not all residents believe HUD when they say no one will get left behind. I spoke to one resident who skipped the meeting, saying she'd heard enough promises. She's at Rosedale Ridge because she's already been disqualified for a housing voucher. She had an assault charge on her record then, and she has a more recent one on it now. She knows she's going to get left behind no matter what HUD says. Richardson Spate thinks there could be a huge chunk of the residents who fall into that category.
There are literally people that have been hiding out, in their own words, at Rosedale for years, kind of sliding under the radar. Nobody's really thinking about that. You know, they owe a $2,000 utility bill in Missouri. And those things will all come to light because everyone will be investigated.
In their haste to fill apartments and get those HUD dollars, Rosedale Ridge wasn't always stringent with their background checks. That helped a lot of people who otherwise might not have qualified for housing. The closing of Rosedale Ridge means the end of that option. It also means the end of a community. As much as residents want to get out of their apartments, they worry about leaving Rosedale Ridge and a community of people who are going through the same things they are.
If they've already had their lives already going and everything, and then I come into the community and it's like, I might need a little bit more help than others, and that might be something that they might be, you know, kind of looking down on.
Javon Swopes also doesn't know how she's going to find a school like the one they have now.
screamed, screamed, and cried.
Frank Rushton Elementary may be the only organization that gets universal support from residents. Ellen Turan is a kindergarten teacher who also volunteers at the after-school program at Rosedale Ridge.
Their life is in upheaval, and it's so important for us to keep this place joyful and positive and to keep it as consistent as possible, because in some cases this is the only consistency they have. And they beg me to let them stay after school on a Friday afternoon. I mean, that's not a normal reaction from a child.
It seems like everyone at Frank Rushton, from Principal Mary Welsh down to the teachers, has stepped up to help these students. Javon Swopes remembers the school's response after an electrical fire in her apartment.
The community, the teachers, the schools helped us in every way possible. They helped us with clothes. They helped us with food. They were just awesome. You know, whatever we was needing, they were there. I just can't thank them enough. That's why I'm having such a hard time to try to part with them.
As the school year winds down, the teachers and community are preparing to say goodbye to about 80 students.
The thing I pray is that they know where this school is. You know, even if it's 10 years down the line, like if they need help or if they need to remember a positive memory, that they will come to one of these places. And regardless if I'm here or whoever is around, that they will know that that is a place that loved them.
But this is all assuming that everyone comes through on all of their promises. And so far, the signs are not good. Remember that HUD meeting the first week of April when Ed Manning said this?
Don't sign up for anything and don't terminate a lease here until the relocation folks come. Okay, and that we'll have a better day for you. Unfortunately, I don't have that today when it's going to be, other than to tell you it's towards the end of the month or the beginning of May. But in the next couple of days, we'll try to nail that down for you.
It's been 6 weeks, and silence. The relocation specialists from HUD haven't arrived yet, nor have the vouchers. Construction crews have been crawling all over the property, ripping out carpeting and painting doors. The management went door to door, asking residents if they'd like to stay in the buildings at a new, lower cost. Which is confusing, since they don't have a rental license and that would be illegal. But with no word from HUD in weeks, some residents say they're tempted to say yes. Last week, Creative Choice, the owners, flew in from Florida for a rental license appeal hearing. Residents, including Javon Swopes, came to testify against them. Here's Chuck Stites, a member of the board, giving his decision directly to those residents.
The only reason that we would be, we came to this conclusion of extending a 30 days is for you guys. Because where do you guys go? Where do you guys go if we say it's you guys got to get out? Where do you guys move to right now?
The residents visibly deflated. They don't want a 30-day extension. They want what they've been promised. Tenant-based vouchers and relocation funds. It's still unclear how this new development will impact that process. As school lets out for the summer, residents are left with as many questions as before. Even Javon Swopes, once so eager to show me her new house, says she isn't sure it's worth the trip. She has no idea when she might move in. All she has is the word of HUD and the rumors swirling around Rosedale Ridge.
And we've been sticking it out, hanging in there, even with all the madness, and still having a smile on our face. And I think sometimes, where do I keep getting this smile from? This is going to get turned around for the better, for us. This is going to work. This is going to happen. You stand in what you believe in.
And she believes she's going to get off that hill. Eventually.
Eleanor Klibanoff brought us that story. When Central Standard returns, we'll talk more about the community piece of this. Obviously, kids are better not living in moldy apartments, but are they also better off leaving the schools where their teachers have been looking out for them? And a neighborhood where everyone's in it together? We'll discuss the current thinking on these questions and more. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. For decades, the popular wisdom on solving problems associated with poverty has emphasized deconcentrating poverty or dispersing it. That's the idea behind the type of housing vouchers residents of Rosedale Ridge have been promised. The goal is to give people access to neighborhoods with more of a mix of incomes and, the theory goes, a broader range of opportunities. If you have ever relied on housing assistance, call 816-235-2888 to tell us what you think of that idea. The number again is 816-235-2888. I'd like to introduce Kirk McClure. He's a professor of urban planning at KU. Hi, Kirk.
Hi, Gina.
Talk to me, first of all, about this idea, the thinking when it comes to dispersing poverty.
The federal government has been in the housing business for a very long time, and we've learned a great deal over those years. Congress is pushing, correctly, that we should do more with our housing dollar than just provide affordable shelter. What they're asking of us is to find ways that when we help a household with affordable shelter, we do something that gives them a platform from which they can escape poverty. So we are trying to find households' locations in better school districts than they might have otherwise, closer proximity to gainful employment, neighborhoods with reduced or no exposure to crime, all the sorts of services that we think about of making a desirable neighborhood.
You've had some interesting findings in your research lately. Can you tell me about those findings and the study that led you to them?
Yes, I can. U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development sponsored some research that a colleague of mine, Bonnie Johnson, and I completed. We were asked to answer a fairly simple question. It says, if a household receives assistance through any of the many federal rental assistance programs, to what extent do they end up in neighborhoods that are better than they would have otherwise? So we looked at where people located, compared it back to all renters and to all poor people. The results are disappointing, I think we have to say. What we found, of course, is nationwide, so it will vary a good deal from metropolitan area to metropolitan area. But we're here in the Kansas City area, which I often say is the bellwether. We are the norm very much within the country. What we find is that rental assistance programs do not do a very compelling job of helping people move to better neighborhoods. Probably the most surprising finding that we came up with is that while we expected the housing choice voucher, we now call it, we're not supposed to call it the Section 8 voucher anymore, but the housing choice voucher was to give a household choice on where to locate. It was of no great surprise to us, given racial discrimination, given all the other problems that go on in the world, that the voucher households were not moving to high opportunity, desirable neighborhoods as much as we'd hoped.
Can I jump in here? Because the terminology that you've used so far is interesting to me. I have to admit that I winced just a little bit at better neighborhood, but higher opportunity neighborhood, that's maybe a euphemism for the same thing. I don't know. Can you talk about your choices in phrasing?
Sure. The phrase high opportunity neighborhood is one of those sad terms in that we don't have a firm definition for it. The U.S. government expects the administrators of the Housing Choice Voucher Program to provide guidance to households, showing them where they can find opportunity for employment, opportunity for schools. In fact, housing authorities are graded on what percentage of their voucher households locate in these neighborhoods. Probably the single most commonly used criterion to define a high opportunity neighborhood is the incidence of poverty. In the United States, right at 14% of all households are in poverty. Interestingly, though, one half of all the neighborhoods in the United States have less than 10% poverty. And that's critical because we find what's referred to as a nonlinear relationship. It's not really a simple thing that says if we have more poverty, things are worse in the neighborhood. That's roughly true, but we have thresholds. If you're in that one half of the neighborhoods with poverty below 10%, poverty seems to have no damaging, deleterious effects to the neighborhood. As you go above 10%, the damaging effects take over. when you reach a critical threshold of, we don't know exactly where, but somewhere between 30% and 40%, at that point, poverty has taken its toll on the neighborhood, and beyond that is no longer harmful.
How common are neighborhoods that have some poverty, but like the amount that you're talking about, the non-deleterious amount of poverty, like under 10%, but no more? I mean, is that common that neighborhoods are predominantly prosperous with just a little bit of poverty?
That is, in fact, that is the norm. One half of all the neighborhoods in the United States have poverty below 10%. The trick to it is that it gets a little more difficult. As people become richer, they will locate in enclaves with fewer rental units. So half of all the neighborhoods in America have below 10% poverty, but that contains only about a third of the rental housing in the United States. The Housing Choice Voucher Program does not allow a voucher holder to live in just any apartment. The government will not subsidize luxury housing. So now we're down to looking at about 26-28% of the program eligible rental units. But that's still one-fourth of all the rental housing out there as in these high opportunity neighborhoods.
So as far as you understand it, can you tell me what you would say is the goal of housing assistance for people with low income?
Well, first and foremost, it still is to make housing affordable. In America, we are blessed in that we – I know it's not a happy thought, but we actually have too much housing.
What do you mean by that?
We literally have too many vacant units in the United States. We have 16 million vacant housing units in the United States. It's a manifestation of the housing bubble 2000 to 2007. Prices ran up, so builders built things like crazy. We're now waiting slowly, slowly for the market to catch up. But while we have too many units, that should make our markets softer, and it is. So that means actually we're at an opportune time for people with a voucher to find a good unit. Now comes the problem. If we give a household complete choice on where they want to locate, their choices are going to be complicated by a lot of things. Sure, we would expect them to want to find housing where they can find employment. And that's one of the great goals of the Housing Choice Voucher Program, is not to just help them with housing, but get them located where they can break that cycle of poverty. But there are still gender discrimination in the workforce. There's race discrimination in the workforce. Landlords are not obligated to accept a Housing Choice Voucher as a form of payment. So it's tricky.
Do you think that the people receiving assistance think of the goal of this assistance as the same as, say, politicians would consider the goal of assistance?
No, we do know that they do not think of it the same way. In many respects, the program is run on a shoestring budget. We wish we had the resources to provide the kind of case management and face-to-face counseling that would really help these households. But in fact, with the resources available, the housing authorities at best can give just a very few man hours to providing a little bit of guidance to these households.
What do you think that your findings about where people choose to live, given the choice maybe with some brackets based on some of the factors that you're describing, but what do you think that the choice to stay in sort of a familiar place might tell us about how human needs fit into the equation?
Well, certainly they do fit in. Households have their own social systems. Especially in the African-American community, the strength of churches is very, very important. But, you know, we've done a lot of research nationwide on this, and we find the social systems are not always positive. In fact, many times there was a very big study called the Moving to Opportunity Program. Households were helped to move to high opportunity neighborhoods. We found many, many stories of people saying, I had to escape where I lived. My family knew where I stored my money. They were stealing from me. that ex-boyfriend knew where I live. He was coming back and beating me up. There's some very horrific stories that come out of it. In fact, if we could have the kind of case management and counseling, we could help people break out of those systems and move into better neighborhoods.
So better case management and counseling is part of what you would say might bridge some of the gap between theory and practice?
Oh, very much so. Housing counseling is one of those, I think, a necessity to make the program work well. Unfortunately, Congress has viewed it as more of a luxury and has cut back funding for it.
How does this stuff play out in Kansas City?
Well, actually, now I'm biased. I'm born and raised here in Kansas City, so I still think Kansas City is the indicator of where programs work. We're a relatively soft housing market.
What does that mean?
It means that there are adequate number of vacant units, and the rents generally are within a range that are affordable to the program. If you know somebody who lives in coastal California or New York City, you know that that's a tight market. But here in Kansas City, we perform fairly well. We have high-quality administration. They cooperate regionally, the various housing authorities. So we have a fairly admirable record of the percentage of our voucher households who move to what are nominally referred to as high opportunity neighborhoods.
I'd like to bring Edwin Lowndes into this conversation. Edwin, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning.
You are with us from the Housing Authority of Kansas City, Missouri, not Kansas City, Kansas, which is deals with Rosedale Ridge, which we just heard about. But talk to me about vouchers here in Kansas City. How do they work?
Well, as Kirk was saying, the vouchers are a terrific program to provide affordable housing. We currently have about 15,000 families on our wait list. And when a family comes in to the top of the wait list, we do a screening to make sure they meet eligibility criteria, which includes a criminal background check and some income checks. We have to make sure that they are at the low income range and a few other minor pieces. And then once they're deemed eligible, we actually work through an orientation program before they actually receive the voucher.
Can I ask you about eligibility real
sure.
quick? Because we did hear from some people in that story who had not been eligible. How does someone with a criminal background of any degree, is there a way for that person to get beyond this state of non-eligibility?
First, there's different degrees of the criminal background. In the voucher program, there's only two areas that are an automatic total lifetime ban, and that's someone that is on the sexual predator list, lifetime, or someone that's been convicted of manufacturing methamphetamine. All the other criminal activity has varying degrees. Petty crimes, we don't look at eligibility regarding that at all. But major crimes, particularly crimes dealing with drugs or other aspects, we use a five-year criteria that if that conviction happened within 5 years, they're deemed ineligible. If it's beyond the 5 years, we don't consider it.
Can I just jump in again? Because mm-hmm. I guess theoretically, it seems like based on the arguments that have been presented here, it's exactly at the moment where a person would not want to slip back into that, that a voucher would be most useful to them. Does that make sense?
It does. And that's where, as I said, you know, we use that as a baseline criteria, the 5 years. But the other piece is if someone has, and these are the terms that are actually in the HUD regulations, successfully completed a rehabilitation program, then they can be deemed eligible. So they can overcome that that impediment to being eligible by showing, I may have been convicted within the last 5 years, but these are the things I'm doing to get my life straight. And so they can become eligible, receive a voucher, and continue that that success. So it's not an automatic, there's no way you can get the voucher. It just puts them on a different path.
And what about this time on the waiting list? Because another thing that I kind of picked up on in that story is that time while someone's waiting, they can be extremely vulnerable to either predatory business concerns mm-hmm. or other things. They just need an option immediately.
And we incorporate that when families come in and actually when they apply for housing, we begin our process at that time as not only – because we can't provide the housing to them. We provide them other options and refer them to other organizations within the city Unfortunately, they're also at capacity. But we do work with them on housing availability. And we also discuss things that they need to do while they are on the wait list. For instance, making sure that they can their utilities are up to date and they don't get large utility bills.
What happens with a large utility bill?
Well, because about 95% of the clients we serve have tenant-paid utilities, they have to be able to get the utilities turned on in their house when they use the voucher. But if they have an outstanding bill with either one MGE or KCP&L, they will not be able to get the utilities turned on, which means they're not going to be able to use their voucher. So we start working with them in advance of make sure you work on that. Also work on your credit history because private landlords will check their credit history. You know, do you have outstanding – do you keep up on your bills going through? Because they want to make sure that that tenant's portion of the rent gets paid. Because one of the misnomers out there is the vast majority, 95-98% of the clients we serve, they pay rent directly to the landlord. It may be as low as, you know, $15 a month or $25 a month, but they do pay rent as well as what's subsidized. So the landlord's going to look at that as well.
So here in Kansas City, once someone has cleared these hurdles, is it your experience that people receiving housing assistance when given the choice still choose to live in a familiar neighborhood that might be subject to high rates of poverty?
It is. It's unfortunate, but the vast majority of the clients we serve will gravitate to the neighborhoods where they are currently living. Or where they're familiar with, as Kirk was saying, whether it's related, I know where my church is, I know where my school is, my family is there. I think it's a part of human nature. You gravitate to things you're familiar with and what you're comfortable with. During our orientation, we do emphasize a vast majority of areas around the city that you can take this voucher anywhere. Some of the impediments that we also face, as Kurt mentioned, is for instance, families here in Kansas City will hesitate to move to the Northland because they're, whether it's real or perception, is like, I don't want to be the only minority up in my neighborhood. But the other aspect is there's no transportation to bring me from the Northland into an employment center here in the central city or where the jobs are. So they do take those other aspects in, but the majority is this is where I'm comfortable with, this is where my family is, and this is where I want to be. That's typically when they start out. Once they get stabilized in those neighborhoods, then we'll see some, not a significant amount, but some movement of families that will go into other neighborhoods once their housing is stabilized.
I know that Kirk has mentioned that a social network can be either positive or negative, just depending on who makes up that social network. But it sounds so compelling to me in a way, just that you would want to be around, I don't know, especially if you're going through a hard time, people you know and people who might help you out. And whether I'm just interested in your thoughts about whether there is any validity in that.
Absolutely there is. It comes from a couple different angles. One of the aspects is a lot of the families we serve don't know about the social networks that are out there and know something differently. For instance, one of the programs that we operate and assist families with is just a standard housekeeping class. And because we'll go in and they may be on the verge of losing their housing because of the way they keep their housing. And a lot of times the response is, I didn't know how to take care of it. And we work with a not-for-profit organization on that. I use that as an example because if they're not familiar with what other neighborhoods are like and they're only familiar with what goes on and where they grew up, they're going to gravitate to that, to the known as opposed to the unknown. So part of what we try to do is to educate and entice folks to understand what is the unknown and make it known to them that these are other viable alternatives and opportunities for them and really stress it is an opportunity for them to do better in their life.
What did you hear in that story we just listened to about Rosedale Ridge? Anything catch your attention with respect to this particular conversation about community versus dispersing?
Well, dispersing can take a whole neighborhood and it can, you know, tear it apart. But the main part that I think I found disturbing in the story was the lack of communication. We have done similar opt-outs, if you will, of project-based vouchers, not in this where it's been a situation of horrific conditions, but usually when a landlord has decided not to continue with a project-based voucher, and we'll work with HUD, and we get in as early as we can with my staff and communicate with those tenants of here are the opportunities, here's what you can do, here's how you can use your voucher, even though we don't have the vouchers ready for them to use. But it's all about education, and it's constant communication with them and letting them know. And then not – you don't make a promise you can't keep. Don't promise them you'll have these within 45 days when you really don't know, because it's human nature. You get up and ready. You pack your stuff up, and then it sits in boxes in the swaller that they're in, and then you become disenchanted. And that really defeats the whole purpose of providing opportunity.
Kirk, I want to get both of you actually talking to me a little bit about this piece of it that's schools, because it's also really understandable that people might be reluctant to yank their kids out of a school or and to especially send their kids to a school where they might perceive that the other kids are going to have more means. Other families aren't going to be dealing with the same situations, and therefore maybe teachers wouldn't be as equipped to handle it.
Well, it's certainly a understandable concern by these households, but the most recent and best research we have looking at the educational gains from housing assistance is very, very positive. Breaking the cycle of poverty is not something that happens quickly and easily. It appears, if anything, to happen on an intergenerational basis. So we move a family to a high-opportunity neighborhood. Years and years later, we see that the children who are moved from a poor quality, poorly resourced inner city school to a highly resourced, high quality school, they have lifetime improvements, higher income earnings, higher sense of well-being.
Does the timing of that transition matter at all, like within the lifespan of that child?
It does, and it's not surprising. It's the younger the child, the more benefits they're going to be. There are also slight gender differences. It is harder for boys to transition than girls to transition. So a middle age or high school boy, the chances of a successful transition is very, very poor. But preschool and grade school children, either gender, seem to succeed very well.
What do you think this is about, though? I mean, it is so interesting that changing locations has this kind of effect. Is there something that can be done to make all neighborhoods have high opportunity, or is that just insane optimism on my part?
We'll go with optimism. I doubt if it's insane. The concept is really fairly textbook ideas. We're talking role models, peer pressure. If children are raised in a world where they rarely see a breadwinner, male or female, in the family, where they rarely see people getting up and going to work on a regular routine basis, then they will not have a sense of what is normally expected of them. If they live in a location where that becomes the norm, then they will adopt the norms of that location.
Well, I think that's right, particularly on the last point. And what we emphasize is within that deconcentration of poverty, and where on the flip side, we call it mixed finance areas. Having the an entire building being project-based voucher, which means 100% low-income families, has a detrimental effect on the families there because their role models are just like them that are very low-income. But if you move to opportunities, whether it's in public housing or in the voucher program, that have mixed incomes, there is that keep-up-with-the-Jones theory that is ingrained in many people that is, well, how did you get to where you are? How can I get to where you are?
This can sound so easily, though, like poor people are the problem. And I don't think that's what you mean. But even things like measuring the criteria for a high-opportunity neighborhood based on a low incidence of poverty, do you hear what I mean?
I understand. No one is saying that poor in and of itself is a bad thing, but it's certainly not a desirable condition. If we could help people away from that, the better. The problem is when we concentrate the poor, and if we have large concentrations, that's a negative. What we have learned from our housing efforts in the past is that Very often we created developments that were 100% occupied by people who were poor. So, in fact, we generated concentrated poverty rather than dispersed poverty.
I think it's also it certainly is not the fault of the person that's low income. But as you put many low income families together, you're not benefiting them. It's similar if you put totally uneducated people all in the same room and say, okay, become educated. They're not really going to be able to follow that.
Kirk McClure, Edwin Lowndes, stay with me through the break. We'll get right back to this conversation about maintaining the ties of community versus dispersing poverty. Call 816-235-2888 to weigh in. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard. Today, we're talking about the need for funding assistance in searching for housing, where people are going to fare better in communities with familiar faces and, say, access to bus routes, or maybe in a fresh place with more opportunities. It's complicated, but so far, our guests in the studio seem to really favor the model of a fresh place with more opportunities. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. Our guests are KU Professor Kirk McClure and Edwin Lowndes of the Kansas City, Missouri Housing Authority. And guys, as I understand it, that idea of building housing projects exclusively for low-income people, that is an idea of the past, essentially?
Absolutely.
Yeah, the quick history is that public housing was something we did from 1937 to the mid-70s. From the mid-70s to just recently, our approach was twin. We would still attach vouchers to buildings. We could also attach vouchers to households. When we attach them to buildings, that's the unwinding that is happening now. The Rosedale Ridge was such a project. From the late 80s to the present, we really only have two approaches, and that is to we build moderate income projects. We no longer build extremely low income projects any longer. The moderate incomes are referred to as low income housing tax credit projects, but they actually serve a slightly more well-off household. And then we have the vouchers for the poorest of the poor. And of course, the goal there is to help them disperse.
There is one an additional model that we use, and we've used it very successfully here in Kansas City and across the country. And that's as we tear down some of the obsolete public housing that concentrated, 200, 300 families all in one, but we're replacing them, we'll put a portion of the public housing, a portion of the tax credits that Kirk mentioned, and then market rate renters all living together in the same complex. And we typically use a one-third, one-third, one-third rule. So that even within that single apartment complex, families see a complete variety of income families and families of means, so that you do have the mentorship and you have the other aspects that families can, particularly on the low income side, can set aspirations. And the families all get together, and it's like any neighborhood. You don't know on your door. Go to your next door neighbor and say, well, how much do you make? You look at how do they live. And there is that incentive even for the low-income family to live just like everyone else, just like the person paying market rate rent.
I'm curious, though, you mentioned earlier that landlords have no obligation to accept these vouchers. How do you encourage people to want to do that given really, stereotypes that are out there, misconceptions that are out there?
Well, from the landlord side, we do a lot of recruiting with landlords. There's a couple organizations here in Kansas City of landlord groups, and we'll do presentations to them. The biggest incentive that a landlord will use for while they'll accept the voucher is they'll receive 50% or 80% of the rent directly from the housing authority on our tenant-based voucher. So they're guaranteed payment of the rent. That's the number one. The second aspect is they want to make sure that they have good quality tenants. So we've done some initial screening, but we still emphasize with that landlord, you are responsible for the ultimate screening of that tenant, just like you would any market rate family. So it kind of works both ways. Landlord, you have a responsibility to make sure you have a quality tenant. And there are avenues that you can take if they're not or later in life. But also they have a responsibility to work with us to make sure that that family is following their obligations. And then we hold the landlord accountable as well, that you're getting the funds that we're paying for the PAP on behalf of the rent. You have to make sure it's quality housing.
I want to take a call from someone who's curious about some of the obstacles facing families who might want to move to a different neighborhood. Well, let's talk to Danielle in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I know that they had touched on it kind of briefly earlier in the conversation, but I was curious about the transportation issue because I know public transportation in Kansas City can be very difficult, even in the city proper. So I can't imagine navigating it, you know, through the suburbs. So my question was, does the city have anything on tap in terms of addressing that issue beyond the trolley that they're doing just in the downtown area? Kind of what ways are they helping families cope with that very real issue?
So, yeah, the public transportation issue that, you know, if you're I am assuming that the voucher doesn't also come with a car.
No, it doesn't. And it doesn't come with funds for transportation either. To the question of whether the city has a transportation problem or a transportation plan, first of all, it's not – I'm not part of the city. We are a separate entity. But each year, the Kansas City Transportation Authority does do public input of where is their ridership and what types of service can we have. Unfortunately, they face the same funding issues that everyone else faces, but they're looking, where is the ridership? And we work with the clients that we serve and the families that we serve in public housing, as well as the housing authority itself, do attend those types of meetings and say, here's where we see the need is. So we provide them information. Ultimately, the authorities at the transportation authority make that decision based on their statistics and where ridership is, and it does. I don't see much change coming in the future.
What about other practical issues, like if someone is using a health clinic that's in a neighborhood where they currently mm-hmm. live, they might not have access to that kind of the same kind of health clinic in a neighborhood where fewer people have a need for that kind of thing.
Well, that's always possible, and that's where I was giving emphasis to the need for good counseling. If we had good case management, that case manager could try to resolve as many of those problems as possible, whether it's transportation, everything right down to where's a laundromat, how do I register my kids at school, where can I find health services to meet my needs. That's what good housing counseling can and should do for people.
Yeah, Kurt's absolutely correct. Unfortunately, there's been a push from the federal government side to be more monofocused or focused only on the housing component as opposed to allow housing authorities and help housing authorities through funding work directly with all the needs and the holistic view of our clients. And we do that not just by direct services because we don't want to create the dependency on us, but seed money, if you will, that can help those clients access the services that are out there generally in the community because Kansas City has a rich history of not-for-profits that are out there to help the low-income families. But how do we connect those families with those services? And that's where the funding to us would really come be in there. And the direct access because we work with our clients on a routine basis. We meet with them at least once a year, but most often more frequently than that. And it's really a question of what do you need and how do we get to you over and above the four walls and a roof.
When you earlier were talking about access to jobs in different neighborhoods and especially in high opportunity neighborhoods, you mentioned, both of you mentioned racial discrimination. Can you flesh out a little bit more what that looks like and where it comes into the picture? Because I thought we had laws against that.
We do. Some of it is real, and it's not just it's veiled in the we don't want those people, and it'll be we mean the low income, but in reality, the vast 90% of the families we serve are minorities, and so those people are minorities, and they'll make judgments based on what they look like and how they perform and how they act. as opposed to, you know, can they do the job? And oftentimes that is just a veiled way of saying, I don't want an African American, or I don't want some other family that's a minority working for me, because that I know what they're going to be like.
Are there cities just quickly that we could look to for good examples of getting beyond some of these things, or no?
There are. Interestingly, Washington, D.C., for all that it's a very tight, very hot real estate market, it's done an admirable job of providing access to high opportunity neighborhoods.
We're going to look that up later. That's all the time we have for today's show. Thanks so much to all the people who spoke with Eleanor Klibanoff at Rosedale Ridge Apartments. And Kirk McClure, professor of urban planning at KU, I appreciate your time. Be sure and keep us posted on your research. Edwin Lowndes of the Housing Authority of Kansas City, Missouri, it's been so helpful to hear your perspective. Thanks.
Thank you.
You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, we'll talk with the author of Bettyville, who chronicled his return from New York to the small Missouri town where he grew up. He came back to care for his ailing mother and ended up forging an uneasy peace with a town he loved, even though being there meant being closeted. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date. Next.